This call is now being recorded.
There we go.
Okay, did you hear that? Yeah.
Yeah, I heard that.
That happened on my end. I hit 4 on Google Voice, and it starts recording the call. And then what it becomes for me is like some kind of a sound file, MP3, 4, WAVE, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Then I can email
it to
you. Yeah,
it's recording now. Yeah.
Yeah, so when we're done, like in 15, 20 minutes, what I should be able to do is either put that in Dropbox if it's too big, or email it to you or whatever, and then you can start manipulating the sound or send it out just to see how you and I sound on the phone together.
Yeah.
Because how we sound regularly, I think, should be a draw for people, right? Because it's a...
Yeah.
No?
Yeah, I think, in fact, what we're right now, the sound quality is good. You know,
so,
I mean,
it sounds great to me, but how do you suppose it really sounds? How, you know what I mean?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, you know what the cell phones do? They cut the upper register and the lower register out. So there is a loss of fidelity when you go to cell phone, and that has to do with bandwidth.
Okay.
But for voice, that's probably not critical. What I was reading in my podcasting thing, for voice, it's not as critical, but for like music and singing, it is very critical.
Okay.
Cut out
so,
the upper frequencies.
Okay. So everything you and I have talked about so far has just been about voice. I wasn't really contemplating music unless you were.
No, I'm not either. You know, what most people do is they download the, I wrote it down the other day. Where was it? It's freesoundfiles.org, I think it is. And you can get these little sound bites as an intro and as an exit. And you know, a lot of people do that. You know, I was thinking of finding a coffee shop that has one of these bells when you go in the door and it rings.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know.
So would you suppose that those would live under, like, ringtones? Because that's, no?
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe not, huh?
I don't know. Not so much as ringtones, but let me see. I wrote it down here. I'm trying to get myself organized, and I'm not doing a very good job.
So you were probably thinking about a tone that said something like, you know, every time, you know, we came back from a break or something or introduced a segment, you'd want like a snappy little jingle tune that says something like, Frank is amazing, right? Just, you know, think out loud. Yeah, right. So you like that Frank is amazing, right?
Write this down.
Oh, man.
Remember that. HTTPS colon.
Oh, sorry. Okay, yeah.
HTTPS / freesound.org.
Oh, yeah. It's autofilled. Okay.
Yeah. And so what I was thinking, if I could find one, there's a lot of little coffee shops around here. I, you know, put my phone on recorder and walk in the door and let the little jingle and say, yeah, I'd like a booth. And... You know, and put that in as the front end intro or something. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. And that, okay, so then what we would want to be aware of is stuff like copyright, right?
Yeah, right. And that's why this free sound, you know, they may have that sort of thing. You know, a lot of little diners and gas stations used to have that kind of thing.
They did, and some, you're right, and little stores still did. When you opened the door, it rang a bell, right?
Yeah.
And those idiotic door chimes replaced some of that. Do you remember, you know what these are? When you open the door and it chimes like an electronic tone? Boom, 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 right?
Yeah. Yeah, but I like the old-fashioned ones. Cause it's,
yeah, I do too.
It's
well,
a,
we're
it's
old.
A down-home, it's a down-home sort of thing, you know?
Okay,
but
so... So we can do that. And incidentally, that memorandum of understanding, but the concept was, okay, so here's what I was doing, right? And this is why two are really better than one. I was thinking about this as Frank noodling around with a podcast, right? Having fun with it and just see where it might go.
Yeah.
It didn't dawn on me until I saw that I might actually have an objection. If you were to say, well, Frank, I'm going to now take this and set it to the sound of monkeys, you know, throwing bananas at people and put it out
there.
Right. Like,
Right.
I'm like, wait a minute, wait a minute, I might really have an objection to this. So rough or not, the concept is spot on, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, and the way you keep friends is have an understanding up front.
Well, and that's Robert Frost, right? Good fences make good neighbors.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't got that many friends that I can say I can go back 30 years with. And
boy, we're coming like, close to that, right?
Yeah, what year did you start at Century 21?
96, so
that was
26
the year.
Years.
Yeah, it was about this month, 26 years ago.
Yeah.
So you're right. Good fences make good neighbors. So I liked it a lot the more I thought about it. I just thought it was like, wow, this is solid. This is what we need. And then I don't really know how we would think about it except to say that friendship comes before commercial interest, and it would be really not okay if somebody just went blazing ahead without agreement. But I don't – is it possible to do something like that, Bob? Like, absent, how do I put, you know, you can get lawyers involved and, you know, we could spend thousands of bucks to make an agreement. Okay. I don't think we want to go that route unless you do.
Oh, no. I think it, you know, if this thing turns into a flaming success and there's lots of cash, okay, then maybe we need to really pound it out and, you know, I mean, maybe you can give up appraising and you can become a podcaster and, In fact, I think you should do some podcasts on things to consider when getting a hiring an appraiser. You know,
there's only one
for that,
Bob. You know, there's only one rule for that whole thing, and you already know what I'm going to say. Two
What's
words:
that?
Hire Frank. That's it. I mean,
hire Frank.
We can go on and on. Am I wrong? I mean,
yeah, no, you're right. Absolutely.
Look, we can blather on all day long about scope of work and where's the bill. We don't care about any of that. Just get Frank on the job. Okay, so with respect to the memorandum, I don't know.
Did you know
Joe
Solomon?
From where? South Carolina, Florida?
Florida. He was the Pasco Real Estate School down on Highway 54. He's a cranky old guy.
So everybody in that space is a cranky old guy. So I ended up doing mine through a group in Tampa, and if you ask me the name of them, I can't remember the name of them.
Well, let me tell you something, and you can write this one down.
Okay.
You know, I went through the broker course, and I taught the finance piece of that for him. You know, so anyway, he says, you know, you got this long definition of fair market value, you know, when the buyer and the seller are aware of all the uses of the thing and all the contingencies. And it goes on and on for about three paragraphs.
It really does, doesn't it?
Yeah. He says, nah, that's not the real definition of fair market value. The real definition is when the buyer and the seller both think they screwed the other guy, that's fair market value.
I can't argue with that because I've heard other guys use that definition, and I've bought and sold enough, and I've brokered enough, and it's really close. It's really close, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. So, but, you know, I mean, I was thinking of this. I mean, when I start reading, like, what I've been working on the last couple of days, the book that I got, you know, it talks about the importance of knowing who your audience is. And in fact, I just sent you some things
I
on
saw.
Your email.
I opened it up. Yeah. It's like a 10-point bullet list.
Yeah. And it's not very expensive. It's really rough. And I think but the guy was really harping on what do your listeners really want? And not only that, what do I feel passionate about? That was the other point that he said. And I am so fed up on one axe denominational, you know, we're the only ones that have the truth.
Right, yeah.
You know, and I saw that.
It shouldn't be that way, but it is, yeah.
It is. You know, I see that in the, you know, on both ends, in the charismatic spectrum, and I see it in the Reformed theologians, you know. Yeah. They both have that, well, we got a corner on God, you know.
So I think we both have some of the same things that we've seen too much of.
Hmm.
and we both have about the same appetite for what we'd like to see maybe a little bit more of. Is that a fair way to say that?
Yeah, I think so.
It's making the circle of what are we passionate about, because I think it's the same circle. I think you and I fit almost into the same circle, and where we don't, I lean maybe a little bit more to experience, you lean a little bit more to the academic, but I don't ever sense a huge difference in what you and I think. Unless you think very differently, you get off the phone thinking, I hate that guy, right? Which is possible. But as a general thing, you and I occupy a big circle. See, that's the reason that we think a lot alike, is our circle is wide of what we think is okay, right?
Yeah.
There's like the eight core, what do you call them, cardinal doctrines?
Yeah, they're cardinal doctrines. Yeah, the Catholics would use the term cardinal. You know, there's actually... 12 major areas of doctrine, some of which are really kind of, they're really optional in terms of, you can be a really sincere Christian and not really, you know a lot about Israelology, for instance.
Okay. So in some of those, you have more formed and informed views than I do. Some of them I never even heard of.
Well,
but
I
when
should.
We talk, well, yeah, that's right. You should. But when we talk, I don't get the sense that we're in disagreement. I get the sense that as we flesh things out, you have the capacity to see, okay, so those non-cardinal doctrines tend to have like a point and a counterpoint in the scriptures. You could make either argument if you really cared to. Like if you could feel passionately about, yeah, if you once saved, always saved, you should be able to flip it around and make the other argument just as passionately, I think,
sure.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. But you can't with the cardinal doctrines. There's no counterpoint, right?
Yeah.
So I think
it's like the Trinity. You know, it is what it is, and you can't understand it, and you can't really define it either.
And there's not like another way to look at it that says, see, it's not really a Trinity at all. There's actually this single Godhead. And I know guys try it, and that's where all the heresy begins. But but with the ones that are non-cardinal, or I don't know what you'd call them, electives, optional, I don't know. But
well, I would call them preferences.
Okay, so you and I could disagree on those, but nobody's salvation is really at risk there, right?
That's right, that's right.
Okay, some guys take those and they elevate them to the level of your salvation hangs in the balance, depending on how you think of movies or tithing or...
whatever. Women in the pulpit is, a litmus test or something.
All right. So with those, the circle that you and I live in is larger than the thing we don't like anymore. So the guys who we say, I'm sick of seeing that, tend to occupy a much, much smaller circle of what's acceptable. When we talk, it's a much larger one. Now, the core ones, you know, the Trinity, the, authority of Scripture and so forth, those aren't debatable. And so we are always in agreement on those, right? As every Christian has to be. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's those bigger ones, the other however many there are, we take a wider view. So the end result is I don't get offended very easily in conversations anymore. I used to, but I don't anymore. Does that make sense? So if you can agree with that, then that sort of defines our circle of what do we want.
Yeah. Have you ever heard the Reformation statement that says, in all things necessary, unity, in all things not necessary, liberty, but in all things charity?
Somewhere along the way, I caught a hold of that quote, and whoever I found it from attributed it to all people of Thomas Jefferson.
Oh, well, I don't know whether it was or not, but I think it predates him back to the 1600s.
I feel like it probably did, because it speaks more to, you know, how to apply theology than it does to how to apply politics. Well, maybe it still applies. So if you and I are sitting here in this bigger circle that says, I really want a more balanced view of God, and that takes some time to get to, and it takes a fair amount of intellectual rigor and a fair amount of living to get there. And And then we say, who's the audience? I suppose we would say the inverse is the people who feel like they've been done a disservice by that narrow, rigorless view of God. Because that other view is by definition narrow, right?
Yeah, very narrow. You know, and what I say, you know, the people who want to throw rocks at everybody but themselves, you know?
So take the list you sent over today. I think it's 8 or 9 bullet points, right? Pod audience, you titled it. Okay. So who do you want to talk to? Post-denominational people, who are they? Well, I think they're the people we're describing, right? The people who have said, wait a minute, I'm positive God is bigger than you're telling me he is.
Yeah.
And they're not heretics saying that we're all God or God is within us. They're not doing that. But they're saying that there has to be more than what I've seen. Is that so post-denominational, you know, you told me years ago, and my experience has shown you to be just spot on that every one of these denominations has like a unique selling proposition.
Mm-hmm.
And
they do.
And for that reason, if they're unwilling to lift up their heads and look around, they can think that they're the only ones who are trying to follow Jesus.
Yeah.
So then what they end up telling people is that God is this big, and if you get on the wrong side of him in any of these preferences, you're in trouble. Your salvation is at risk. And then people either I think they have to become post-denominational, no?
Well, and they almost, and it's not just post-denominational, they almost have to be trans-denominational. And I don't know that there's a word out there, but I mean, I like to say that if you listen to any of the great traditions in the Christendom, that if you listen to them long enough, you'll learn something that's very deep and very good and worth preserving. The problem is anybody who doesn't see it their way is instantly labeled a heretic, you know.
So, okay. So this question of pod audience, it's the second point you wrote was those who are tenderized toward God but still seeking a quality relationship with him.
Mm-hmm.
It almost feels like those are it's not a different group. It feels like the post-denominational or later the trans-denominational, because that's probably where you've gotten to, and I know that's where I've gotten to, is I'm not quite in the just Jesus group at the end, right? Because those guys tend to sometimes, in my experience, be a little bit angry and a little bit, a little confrontational almost, you know, a little too willing to...
Mm-hmm.
To throw everything out to say it's just
thing, it's an anti-intellectualism at a certain level.
Yeah, that's fair, because that's where Pentecostalism ends up going.
It's okay with a 6-year-old to have a very primitive theology, but if you've been a Christian 5 or 10 years, you should know a little more than just Jesus. You should know a little bit about God himself, the Father, and the Holy Spirit, and the Scripture. And now, are those a checklist that at the pearly gates they're going to make sure that you pass the doctrinal test? I don't think so. It's just Jesus at the doctrine, at the entry point. But if that's all you know, you're a pretty, I don't know, weak Christian?
Okay, maybe not weak, but maybe not well-rounded. So trial comes in a variety of flavors and forms. And those trials teach me something about the contours of God, right? So in the beginning, and let's agree that the answer to every question probably is ultimately, like they say, it's all Jesus. I could probably agree with that. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, who created the world and you know what? Okay. But daily living says I ought to have a little bit better, how would you describe that, a little fuller?
Struggling. Well, that's why I didn't like the word transdenominational, but you need to have, well, it's like the book of Proverbs, you know. Those are not promises. Those are general principles, you know.
And if you dig through Proverbs deep at all, and for years, I don't know if I ever told you this, but for years, Wendy and I would read a chapter out loud every day. And we did that for like 10 years. And what happens is the Proverbs become baked down into your language and vocabulary, everything, right?
Yeah.
And what happens is you can't hold Proverbs too tightly because there are Proverbs in there that flatly contradict each other.
Yeah.
And if you ask me for an example at this moment, I can't give you one. But I know that they're there because Wendy and I have talked about them. And it's not that they're wrong. It's that they really are guides. So this will be true in this circumstance, and this will be true in another circumstance.
Yep.
Here's an example. And don't ask me what chapter it's from, but it's like chapter 2 or 3. Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. Next verse. Mm-hmm. Don't answer a fool according to his folly, lest you become like him.
Mm-hmm.
Two verses, one instantly after the other, and one's telling you answer the fool according to his folly. The next one says don't, which is true. Well, they both are.
Yeah,
they both are. They're just
not always true at every moment. Wisdom is knowing when to apply them.
Sure. So okay. When is Jesus God? Well, always. So that's
always.
Not a principle. That's real. That's truth. It's undebatable truth. That's how I see it, anyways.
Yeah. Well, and that's why they call it the wisdom literature, you know, Proverbs. The poetries are all wisdom literature.
Okay. So the people we're looking for then, so in this trans-denominational aspect of it, you used to tell me that the denominations each got, they didn't just have a unique selling proposition. It wasn't just like, you know, ours is now with 25% more crystals. It wasn't that. It was, here's a thing that we've latched onto about the nature of God that we believe is so significant, it will become an organizing doctrine around our denomination.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe a bad example, you could throw in dozens of good ones, but the way the Catholics approach communion, it's really distinctive. Mm-hmm. It's very distinctive.
Yeah.
Jesus bodily shows up in the communion. So the whole service, the whole weekly life of the congregation is oriented around that communion service, and it's not a joke, right? This is, and it shows up in their architecture. It shows up. They're not going to do this they will if they have to. But where they don't have to, they're going to build a cathedral, you know, where they don't have to like do this down at the bowling alley, right? They will if they had to. But the majesty of God requires a majestic house, and you can see their view of communion. In their view of architecture, in my opinion, right?
Mm-hmm.
Contrast that with the personal friend nature of God with the Pentecostals, and it shows up in their view of communion.
Mm-hmm.
It's this casual affair, almost like at your kitchen table, which is kind of how I think of the Last Supper. You know what I mean? It's like, are they wrong? No, but they were sort of like unique approaches to the same kinds of question. Now, I may be misunderstanding what you used to tell me, but that's kind of how I've interpreted it and lived by it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and
when you do that, I know I'm going to get the skin flayed off me. Huh?
No. Well, you know, and that's part of the whole, when in the new member class at Crossings, they used to teach on communion because the Presbyterians have a reformed view of communion. And yet a third of the people coming to that church were out of a Roman Catholic background, and they believe in transubstantiation, which is the Catholic view, you know. And the Lutherans are consubstantiation. The Reformed view is something more than a symbol. And then, you know, some of the primitive Baptists, it's purely a symbol, you know. And you can kind of build a case for, you know, it doesn't give you any days off of purgatory like the Catholics would teach. You know, that's where they've gone really off the wall, you know.
So take that idea of who are we trying to reach and what's the value of trans-denominationalism. Well, if I have a better sense of how these other brothers in Christ view things like communion, tithing, whatever, right? I went to visit a Portuguese church. I sent you an email about this. They're called the Congregational Church in the United States. And they come from...
Yes, I remember that. Yes.
They're all sort of like around Chicago, but there's like some scattered through metropolitan areas. Anyways, I went to this one, and for whatever reason, this whole denomination in the United States is largely Portuguese. So they're Brazilian too. So this is what happened. These guys came from Brazil. That's where a lot of this came from. That's how it got here.
Yeah. Anyways. Yeah. And they came out of synchronism with the Roman Catholics. Yeah.
So I'm sitting in this service. It's a Friday night service. Orderly. Everything's in good order. Right? The one theme that everybody kept talking about, whether it was people coming up to give testimonies, people asking for prayer, the word that the pastor brought, it was all about vows. They took vows in that church very, very seriously as a front burner issue that everybody ought to be acquainted with. Hmm. And it wasn't like putting God to the test. It was, I made a vow, I paid the vow. I made a vow, I paid the vow. And it was like, you never hear people talk like that. Bob, I'm telling you, these people were all about, I really sought the Lord's face in prayer on this, and then I made a vow, and I made sure to pay it. And wow. They never said what the payment was. So maybe the payment was time, maybe it was something, right?
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, this concept of vows percolated down into the daily life of the church, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's good or bad. You know, you can find error and all that stuff, right? But what did it do? It said something about the nature of God. You and I have talked about this before, about God as a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And just the legal aspects of the Christian faith. Well, these people tapped into what is a promise, is what I sensed.
Well,
you know, the contractual obligations of a promise. Now, they're unilateral promises, but still, they still caught hold of something in there that was really interesting. So I guess the point that I'm taking out of your pod audience email today is sort of who are we really trying to reach? And it's people who are looking for and need a fuller experience and a fuller education of God.
How about the word people who want to live a life of integrity as to what they understand of God at the present time?
So I think I know what you mean by that. But sometimes in the Christian world, phrases get used too much and they become almost worn out or hackneyed. When somebody says, I want to live a life of integrity, it's like, I'm not sure what you mean. I know what you mean. I think I know what you mean. It's an authentic experience with the living God, which means...
That's right.
I'm going to sit here under his microscope, not Frank's, but God's, and he's going to clean me up in the way that I need to be cleaned up as he reveals himself to me. That's kind of what I think you're saying, right?
Yeah.
Am I off? How far am I on?
No, I think you're right. I mean, when I think of integrity, I think of, okay, we don't earn our way into heaven, but as he reveals who I am and my weak spots and my sin, and as I get a fuller picture of him, do I try to bring my life in concert or in synchronicity with what I know of him and of the scriptures?
A really deliberate, conscious, methodical.
Yeah. And in fact, you know, I like that methodical. The Methodists had a lot of things going for them because they were methodical.
Yeah, they did.
I mean, it tends to go to legalism sometimes.
Right.
I'm making noise. Okay.
And let's agree that everything will, you know, real true doctrine is always one step away from some grievous error, right? That's how I see it. It's, you're always sort of on the straight and narrow, and you're always one step away from going right up to your neck in the slough of the spawn. That's how I see it. So,
well, think about all the creeds from the Apostles' Creed forward, the Confessions of Dort, the Westminster Confession, you know, the Baptist Confession of 1689, whatever. All of them are written in response to an excess or a heresy that was common in the church at that time.
So we're trying to take our, I'll call it shared, view of what the Christian life looks like. And I don't mean the going through the motions. I mean the profitable, and I don't mean financially profitable. I mean the spiritually profitable life.
Yeah.
And
coming
saying
to a certain spiritual maturity. Yeah.
And saying that, number one, I can't do it alone. It really is a team sport, even though the results are individual.
Mm-hmm.
And then saying number two, that there are other people out there like that who want the same thing. And they're looking for someone to talk with them, not to them or at them or about them.
Mm-hmm.
But they're looking for somebody to talk with them about the things that they're grappling with. And my sense is, if I'm right in all the things we've just been saying, and if I'm seeing it as it is, we're probably grappling with stuff and always have that those kinds of people would too. In other words, there wouldn't be any special different thing that needed to be done. Like your daily devotions are probably sufficient to drive a podcast.
Hmm.
That would just be my guess off the top of my head.
Hmm.
Only because your daily devotions. Well, and I'm not either. I'm just laying it out as a theory. But when we used to sit and visit at Wendy's, I wasn't preparing for those. I don't think you were. In fact, I know you weren't.
No,
you were living.
Yeah, no. I was just well, and I think what you're saying about getting the greater view, you know, some people want to be told what to believe and how to believe it, and any deviation is heresy. And that's not where I'm at.
But it might have been 35, 40, 50 years ago. It might have been where you were at, right?
Yeah,
it might have been.
That was real, yeah, at times, definitely.
So because you were an oxygen-breathing, carbon-based biped made in the image of the living God, you probably came in like that, right? And the way, I don't remember if you ever met our friend Frankie. I think you did once. I don't remember. But he used to have this expression. Yeah, big Frankie. No, it was Frankie Steinbeck, right? So
yeah.
He used to have this expression for the Christian life. And he was really candid about it. He'd say, look, I'm hanging on by a thread here. I feel like I'm just learning how to ride a bike. And if you touch me, I'm going to fall over. Right? So in the
that
very
is
version,
a great expression. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it was. So isn't that really how people live in the beginning? Is if you don't touch me, don't bump me, get away from me, show me the guardrails, tell me the rules.
Are they here,
okay.
Glenn? Oh, okay. I'm sorry, Frank. We're expecting a mattress delivery here. So I asked. She's going in and out like they were delivering, but they haven't yet.
All right. So
yeah,
so
that,
basically,
actually, you know, in a lot of ways, that's still true, you know, because I'm trying to, you know, he who thinks he has all the answers needs yet to be taught is kind of one of my subtext motives, you know, and, you know, I read things and I say, oh, that's different. Oh, I really missed that one. You know, and the Christian life, you know, I guess that's why I have a problem with some of the holiness people, which, you know what I'm talking about when I say holiness.
I think so. It's for people who, it seems to show up more in the Pentecostal world and more in the black churches.
Yeah.
And it's a very rigid conservative view that basically says, I don't really know exactly what it says, but it gives the appearance of saying that your job is to root sin out of your own camp. It isn't really God cleaning you up, it's you cleaning you up, but I could be wrong.
Oh, well, the holiness movement, as I use the term, I'm thinking of, you know, once I've received the second blessing, I don't sin anymore ever. And there's a sense of arrogance of arrival. And therefore, as the pastor, it's my job to root out sin in your job, in your life.
I know that that exists, but I have a something of a thought that that's a really, I'll tell you, there's somebody who did believe that. It was Charles Finney. If you've ever read him, the evangelist.
Yeah, well.
I think he held that view. I think he held that view.
Wigglesworth did too, I think.
So yeah, I think some of those guys did. And I guess the closer you are to some revelation like that, the more life it has. And the further you get from it, the more law it has, would be my guess.
Yeah.
If I'm trying to tell you about, when you try to tell me about classes you've taken in seminary, they mean almost nothing to me because I don't know anybody and I couldn't hear the guy's voice teach. You know what I mean? There's no emotion in it. There's no life in it. It's just you telling me a story. And I try hard, but it isn't the same. That's what I wonder. I don't know.
Wow. Well, don't quote me, but seminary to some extent is a waste.
Oh my word. Know. Hold on. I'm glad we're recording this. Oh, Jared, you know, I thought we were having an earthquake. I got to tell Wendy. Hang on.
the first time around I heard it, you know, when the campus they're here. Let me see if they need my help delivering a mattress here. The first time I heard a lot of the stuff, I need to open that door. Frank, can I call you back in 10?
Absolutely.
Okay.